One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging. It's often your hormones, too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today. And get your old self back naturally.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 123. A brief overview of post-conquest Latin American history. Part 8. The end of Cold War politics. The last two episodes of this series moved into territory some of you might personally remember, as we looked at the second half of the 20th century and how the Cold War played out in Latin America. That leaves us with just the most recent history of the region to deal with, stuff which almost all of us have lived through. Today we reach the present day, and issues which we'll probably be familiar with. It also means that some of it might soon be out of date, as events in the near future play out. This episode will focus on the end of those Cold War conflicts, largely the dictators and the insurgencies, while also looking at some of the exceptions to that trend. The next and final episode of the series will look at political occurrences since around the year 2000, as well as some of the economic, social, and religious features of the most recent decades. Just as we began our look at the Cold War a couple of episodes ago by discussing the conflicts which immediately preceded it, the World Wars, today there is one more conflict we should talk about from the end of the period covered last episode. The Falklands / Malvinas War does not fit neatly into the major trends which this series deals with. It is a bit of an anomaly. It is mainly for reasons of balancing episode length that I put it here, instead of in the last one. Now this is also a conflict which directly involves my own country, and it happened just before my lifetime. Its recency means that it still has meaning today for many people. This all means that I feel a certain responsibility to ensure that I try to present it here in an accurate and neutral way. So hopefully I succeed. The roots of the conflict go back to colonial times. The islands were uninhabited, and Spain, Britain, and even France all claimed them at various points, and sent people to make their homes there. Britain's empire in the 1800s stretched across the world, including many places on far-flung parts of the globe, extremely distant to the country itself. Most eventually became independent, but the tiny British settler population of the Falklands / Malvinas did not have a separate pre-existing identity which pulled them away from the fading empire in the same way as elsewhere. Unlike somewhere like Australia or New Zealand, also largely populated by British and Irish descendants, they were not big enough to see a viable independent future for themselves. Of course, the nearest landmass is Argentina, and with those Spanish claims, there had always been a belief that the islands should be part of Argentine territory. Both nations were experiencing hard times when the war began. Argentina was in the later years of its military dictatorship, and it was suffering economically, a situation which cast doubt on the legitimacy of the junta. Meanwhile, Britain was coming to terms with its decline in the international order. Accompanying this identity crisis was an economic one. The 1970s had been difficult, and Margaret Thatcher had been elected. Her vision for the country included sweeping economic changes, which favoured free markets, and sought to clear away what she saw as the obstacles to rebirth, posed by things like labour laws and capital restrictions. This programme was just beginning at this point, however, and the results had not yet emerged. War can be a great way to distract from problems at home, and to stir patriotic support for government. In Britain's case, it was also a chance to dispel the doom and gloom around the end of empire, a last hurrah to prove that the country could still assert itself on the world stage. The Argentine belief was that Britain would not be willing or able to mobilise its diminished resources, given the problems it faced at home, to defend such a small and distant territory. The gamble that the military junta made was that Britain would not even try. Thatcher, however, loved a challenge, not just on this, but in regards to things at home, like her battles against the unions. She wasn't going to let this go, but defending the islands was a gamble for her too. It wasn't clear that Britain was actually capable of mobilising its military, with no notice to such a distant place. Having made the first move, Argentina had occupied the islands, and it was up to Britain to scramble together a response. Once its ships had reached the area, they began attacking Argentine positions to clear the way for a land invasion. It was at this time that the most controversial incident occurred. A British submarine sunk the General Belgrano warship, causing the death of 323 sailors, almost half of the Argentine total for the war as a whole. Britain itself had drawn a boundary in the sea, within which was the conflict zone. The Belgrano was outside of this boundary, and so many said that the attack should not have happened. After managing to land, the British gradually made their way across the islands. The Argentine effort was hampered by the fact that many of its soldiers were conscripts. International opinion largely split depending on geography. Europe supported Britain, while Latin America backed Argentina. Neighbouring Chile was an exception, however, and because the two countries had a separate disagreement about their borders, the Argentine junta decided that they had to keep their best forces on the mainland in case they were needed for defence. This obviously meant that they were not deployed in the attempt to repel the British. The war lasted for 74 days before Argentina withdrew. 649 of their soldiers, 255 British ones, and 3 of the island's inhabitants had died. The Falklands-Malvinas War came right at the end of Argentina's period of military dictatorship. The dissolving of the junta was announced just months after its end, and so the war probably greatly sped up this transition. This change of government was part of a wave of moves in this direction, however, which saw dictators replaced with democracy in and around the 1980s. This was one side of the end of those Cold War battles. There weren't large uprisings which forced them out of office, although increasingly brave social movements played a big part. Neither were there dramatic external interventions, for the most part. Instead, the transitions were usually gradual and managed by the dictatorships and juntas themselves. One of the major factors for this were the economic difficulties which Latin America faced in the 1980s, and which we will look at in detail next episode. For now, though, I will say that things were bad for vast swathes of the population, and that, as this happened on the watch of the dictators, it helped put pressure on them to hold elections as populations became more outspoken in their demands for change. Pressure also came from outside. The US encouraged the transition to democracy, in contrast to their previous policies, and the Pope even played a part in pressuring the dictators to hand over power. Since these dictators and juntas stepped down, Latin America's politics, while sometimes rocky, has been marked by democracy. We haven't really seen attempts in these countries, previously run by juntas and dictators, to revert back to that previous model, although there are a few exceptions. Now on the other side, most of those left-wing insurgencies have also come to an end. In some countries, former rebels have embraced politics, and a few ex-guerrillas have even become presidents. Rousseff in Brazil, Mujica in Uruguay, and more recently Petro in Colombia are examples of this. Just like these figureheads, in many countries, the ambitions of the left have been tempered. Not many politicians advocate implementing some form of Marxism anymore. Those I've just mentioned, for example, accept free market capitalism, but broadly seek to regulate it and use it to improve the lots of the worst off in society. Part of the reason for the end of armed campaigns is that democracy had returned in most countries. More generally, though, these kinds of groups were declining in many parts of the world. The end of the USSR and communism in Eastern Europe was obviously a big part in bringing an end to this kind of politics. Now, I don't want to overstate this too much. At ground level, Latin America is still a very politically vibrant place. Workers' movements, unions, protests against foreign multinationals, indigenous movements, cooperative forms of economic enterprise, these are all still pretty common in Latin America, more so than in other parts of the world. As recently as 2006, a teachers' strike in Oaxaca, Mexico, evolved into a general uprising, which saw the city taken out of state hands and run as an anarchist-style commune for 6 months. Communist parties don't generally threaten to win elections, but they probably achieve higher numbers than they do in the West these days.
Everyone's talking about AI these days, right? This season on Compiler, we're diving deep into how AI is reshaping the world we live in. Join us for a new season of Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging. It's often your hormones, too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
Work takes up most of your time. That's why you should use stamps.com to save time with your mailing and shipping, and have flexibility to focus on more important things. Stamps.com can handle all your mailing and shipping needs with rates up to 88% off USPS and UPS. Add flexibility to your day with Stamps.com. Go to stamps.com/program to sign up for a special offer. No contract, cancel anytime. That's stamps.com/program.
For the most part, Cold War politics are over, though, as in the rest of the world. There are always exceptions, and you can separate these into two categories. In some places, the insurgencies continue. Technically, the Shining Path still exists in Peru, for example, although it is confined to a small area and is fairly powerless. A tiny organization in Paraguay, called the Paraguayan People's Army, still exists in that country, occasionally engages in kidnapping in the northeast of the country, while a group called the Popular Revolutionary Army may still exist in Mexico, although it's been pretty quiet since they blew up oil infrastructure in 2007 and faced a crackdown. I'm sure there are other examples dotted around Latin America. Colombia, though, is the big one. We will come back to this next episode, as it links into another trend we need to discuss. But Colombia's conflict is still going, even if the situation is much improved. A landmark peace deal was signed with the FARC, the largest guerrilla group, in 2017, which saw most of it hand over their weapons and some of its leaders join conventional politics. Some FARC groups, however, did not disarm and continue to be active in parts of the country. Other groups also still exist, most notably the ELN, the National Army of Liberation. Now, as we'll see next episode, their commitment to their political ideology today is questionable, but given their origins and rhetoric, you do have to class this as a holdover from those Cold War battles. The other category of those Cold War holdouts can be found in Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba. I said that the dictators had faded out. However, in these countries, left-wing dictatorships have emerged, even if the reality usually doesn't match the rhetoric. Nicaragua's situation directly links to its Cold War past. The Sandinistas, having successfully played the biggest part in the overthrowing of the Somoza dynasty, fought off the Contras and, led by Daniel Ortega, ruled the country after the revolution. In 1990, however, they lost an election, and Ortega respected the result. The Sandinistas spent 16 years out of power before being elected again. Since then, however, Ortega has demonstrated a clear desire to hold on to power and to crack down on opposition. There was a wave of protest in 2018, which saw harsh measures used to suppress it, and many critics have now gone into exile. Today the country is technically a democracy, but is looking increasingly dictatorial, and he has recently changed the constitution to put limits on civil society and to make his wife co-president. NGOs, journalists, and the Catholic Church have been targeted in particular. I did research for my master's degree in Nicaragua 11 years ago, focusing on a social movement in a village led by the local priest and opposing a Canadian mining company which wanted to extract gold there. The villagers made allegations of attacks against them, which they believed were organised by the government. In the end, the mine was not given permission to start work. But I think this illustrates the gap between Sandinista rhetoric and reality. For the purpose of this point, the rights and wrongs of the mine are irrelevant. I think the informative point is that the government says it's still a socialist one, and one of the drives of the revolution was opposition to the willingness of the Somozas to allow the country's wealth to flow abroad while taking a cut themselves. Allegedly using underhand tactics to support a foreign extractive multinational in the face of local opposition does not fit neatly into the Sandinistas' ideological story. Neither do alleged threats against a liberation theology-inspired priest. Furthermore, Ortega's attempts to secure his family's power are making him look a little like that dynasty which the revolution replaced. Still, given that rhetoric and that revolutionary legacy, Nicaragua can be classed as a holdover from the Cold War period. Today it's one of the poorest countries in the Americas. Most people put it in second place behind Haiti. There are so many reasons for this. The looting of the Somozas, the costly war to dislodge them, US interventions and the war against the Contras, and now the governorship of Ortega. Whatever your politics, it's a pretty sad story. Venezuela is slightly different. Its move to the left actually came after the end of the Cold War. Hugo Chavez was a soldier who had long been involved in trying to organise left-wing revolutionary groups within the army. In 1992, he attempted to launch a coup, but he only spent a couple of years in prison for this, before a new president decided to free him. Chavez did win legitimate election in 1998. I'm classing this government as an example of an old-fashioned leftist one, because that is usually how it's seen. Chavez himself said conflicting things about his connection to Marxist ideas. He described his ideology as Bolivarian, a continuation of Simón Bolívar's fight against imperialism. He was certainly not a fan of capitalism, and later on he advocated for socialism for the 21st century. He was also close to Fidel Castro's Cuba. Using Venezuela's vast amounts of oil money, he instituted social programs, as well as making changes to the constitution, which alarmed onlookers and his opponents. In 2002, a march in opposition to him made its way to the presidential palace, where it was met by his supporters among the population. Violence broke out, and the army decided to intervene and remove Chavez from power. He was imprisoned for 47 hours, and a new president was declared, before pressure from his supporters, who had never left the streets, persuaded the presidential guard to intervene and restore him to power. Chavez remained in control until his death in 2013, when his vice president, Nicolás Maduro, took charge. He is still in power today, after a series of disputed elections. In the early years, Venezuela was seen among some on the left as a positive, as a rebuttal to the dominance of free market capitalism, which they opposed. It's hard to sustain that position today. Despite the vast oil wealth, the country's economy is a complete mess, and it appears that Maduro has no intention of ever giving up power. Many, many Venezuelans have left, and I have encountered them all over Latin America on my travels. Despite internal attempts to remove the government, and plenty of external pressure, Maduro's administration has proven extremely resilient. So unlike Nicaragua and Venezuela, where socialist governments either regained power or came into existence after the end of the Cold War, Cuba has just doggedly hung on. Fidel Castro ran the country until his death in 2008, when power passed to his brother Raúl. Raúl retired after 10 years, but the party is still in control of government. What was perhaps the most talked about country in Latin America has now largely passed from the world's gaze. When people discuss socialism, they are more likely to talk about Venezuela today than Cuba. The country was badly hit by the loss of its sponsor, the Soviet Union, and a difficult period followed. Compromises were made to allow some capitalist-style features into the economy, and tourism was embraced as a source of much-needed income. The US economic blockade remains in place. The government has carried on, and so now it forms an interesting curiosity. I have seen some articles in the last year, however, which suggest that Cuba is currently going through another difficult time. It's hard to say how difficult, and if this will have any consequences, but it may be something to watch. As in the rest of the world, and those exceptions aside, the fall of the Soviet Union largely brought an end to the belief that a radically different ideological left-wing economic system could be created. In the 1990s, there was talk of the end of history, the idea that the big battles of the past were over. The liberal capitalist democracy had won out, and the future would consist of non-political, technocratic tinkering to fix the problems which remained. It hasn't quite played out like that. I think that Islamic ideologies are a good example of resistance to this idea. And obviously today, we are seeing a reaction to this coming out of the West itself, in the form of anti-globalization politics, advocating for things like tariffs and immigration controls. A lot of that reaction is coming from the right, but there is one example from Latin America, which emerged from the left, and which, coming at almost the very moment those left-wing battles were dying out, is truly an exception to the global direction of traffic. On New Year's Day 1994, the moment when a new free trade agreement named NAFTA came into effect, Mexico was shocked by an indigenous Maya uprising in its southernmost state, Chiapas. It was highly organized, and the Zapatistas, as they called themselves, claiming the legacy of Emiliano Zapata, that leader during the Mexican Revolution, took over most of the state's major towns and cities. The government responded by fighting back, but popular opinion helped pressure them into a ceasefire and negotiations. These eventually collapsed, but the Mexican government never tried to reassert its control in Zapatista territories, and to this day they run large parts of Chiapas and have implemented their own system of government, which mixes traditional Maya forms of social organization with modern left-wing anti-capitalist ideas. Next episode, we'll finish off this series with a look at the most recent political events, as well as some of the economic and social trends which have marked Latin America in recent years. If you've enjoyed this episode and you want to help out, one thing which helps new people discover the show is leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts from. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done this, and thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by me, Max Argent, edited by Alex McNamara. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to get access to extra episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast is also available on YouTube by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. If you'd like to send me a message, or if you have any questions, you can email me at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.